The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And good morning and welcome to this November 20th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes under Writers on Writing. We are on Stitcher. We are everywhere you consume your podcasts, you can find us. And we are still inviting you to write us with your thoughts. You guys have provided us with so much great feedback, and we just love to keep that coming. You can email Barbara at penonfire@earthlink.net, penonfire@earthlink.net. You can email me at mariestone@gmail.com. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm here with KUCI intern Elizabeth Montoya. Elizabeth, hello.
Hello.
It's okay. You can say hello. And we are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. One of the thoughts that you have written into us about is that you'd like more authors on for the full hour. And so we're going to do that today. As somebody else posted that they really like hearing from authors from small independent presses, so we're also going to do that today. So Jean Blasberg is on for the full hour. I pre-recorded this on Monday, and so sit back, relax, and enjoy Jean Blasberg. Jean Blasberg is a novelist, travel writer, and adventurer. Her debut novel, Eden, was the winner of the Beverly Hills Book Awards for Women's Fiction, as well as a finalist for the Benjamin Franklin Award for Best New Voice in Fiction and Sarton's Women's Book Award for Historical Fiction. Jean sits on the boards of the Boston Book Festival and Grub Street, one of the country's preeminent creative writing centers. Her latest novel is The Nine. It is published by She Writes Press, and we are going to talk about all of this morning. Jean, welcome.
Thank you, Marie. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, thanks for doing this. So before we dive in, what I didn't mention in the introduction is that you originally came from a career in finance. And, you know, I talked to a ton of kind of recovering lawyers and some therapists and some doctors, but I haven't talked to a ton of Wall Street or Harvard Business School types. So because we have the luxury of time, I'd just love to hear if there is anything from sort of your prior life that you draw from or anything that you brought with you that kind of helps in your writing life now.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So my Wall Street life really was my first career out of college. I went into investment banking. It was a great first job. You know, these companies come on campus and recruit and wave all sorts of perks in front of your face. But to me, the exciting thing was that I'd be living in New York City and I'd be financially independent from my family and kind of rooming with a couple of my good friends. And the whole package is what really drew me. It wasn't the smartest career choice in the world. I'm good with numbers. I have a very analytical mind. But it was a high-stress position, and I was constantly in fear that I was making a mistake. So I worked really, really hard for many, I guess it was a 2 or 3 year position. It was like an entry-level analyst program. From there, I went to also work in finance, but I was at Macy's, and it was then Federated Department Stores in Cincinnati. And I moved there with my now husband and started working again, but in a big company setting, still with numbers. We were going through a bankruptcy. We were evaluating all kinds of mergers, and it was, again, a lot of hours. Working with people, though, that were better coaches, and I was better suited towards that role. Mm-hmm. But again, it was kind of like it was the best job available. It wasn't really ever I think what I was intended to do.
Yeah.
But again, being very practical and taking the best job available was then what happened was we moved back to Boston, and I had this pretty good run at first Boston and then at Federated, and I was looking for something I could do that would use my that experience with the retailers, but I was thinking about maybe becoming a research analyst. I like the idea of doing research on companies and writing about them. And as I was looking for a position in that area, I met the retailing professor at Harvard Business School who needed a research assistant. And what research assistants do at Harvard Business School is basically write the case studies for the classes. So I did that for 3 years. And what I found that I loved was the writing lifestyle. There was the research, but then there was something I could do on my own terms in my own hours. And as I was starting a family, I really started to envision that this could be a balancing act I might be able to pull off. So that was the beauty of that job at HBS. It wasn't so much I was like on the, I had kind of left that number side, and that was really ironically the beginning of my writing life. So from there, the professor I was working for eventually retired, and I started taking a lot of classes at night. I had young kids, and I'd get out at night either taking, you know, there's just so many universities and adult education classes in Boston, and that's one of the beauties of living in a city with a lot of universities. I thought maybe journalism, or maybe it would be, you know, I took a lot of different classes. It's a lot in the art of memoir. And anyway, I'm kind of being very long-winded about it was an evolution of kind of thinking this through, and I take steps that are kind of lengthy, try things for a couple of years, and then figure out how is this now leading to something I'd like to do.
Right.
But after the Harvard Business School experience, and as I started to take classes, and as my husband and I started to have children, it just was a natural crossroads to kind of stop and pause. And I was determined to then start making decisions, not based on the best job available, but like, what did I really want to do? And I guess there was also a little bit of fear and uncertainty that I wasn't equipped to do what I really wanted to do, which was to write and be published. So thus I took all those classes and took little baby steps in terms of getting published. Had, you know, a couple of nonfiction pieces published in small journals. And I was the president of the United States Squash Rackets Association for a while. So I had like a monthly column in that magazine that was also good practice for, you know, getting my thoughts on paper. But I started taking all these memoir writing classes, and our teacher gave us prompts every week, and I swear, regardless of what the prompt was or the assignment, my piece week after week would come back somehow to my mother and come back to the fact that I was now a mother and I was a daughter, and it was this evaluation of how my relationship had gone with my mother and how I wanted the future to be. And so the reason I'm telling you this is because I feel like memoirists, and the beauty of memoir is that after doing a lot of writing and reflecting on what you've created, you start to see the themes in it, and you start to see the universal themes and the themes that might be interesting to other people. And I wanted to take those themes and then create a fictional narrative around those. I really made a decision that I didn't want to write about my own life, but that I wanted to still write about these themes of family and parenting and motherhood and inheritance and what we pass down and what we intentionally or unintentionally take on. And so the thing that the finance job really helped with, and what I guess I could have what I say I drew from is that I know how to really work hard.
Yeah.
And I know when I don't know something. Well, I basically know when I don't know something, but I guess I'm not afraid of hard work because I really muscled through those years with brawn instead of sheer talent. And so I know that that's always one way of getting from A to B.
Yeah.
I guess the other thing is that I'm a logical person and I'm an analytical thinker. So in the two novels I've written, I've actually at different points put everything into a spreadsheet. So I figure out my point of view characters, if they're all getting equal airtime, if they are spaced out evenly. Like, I do a lot of analysis of the document, of slicing and dicing it to make sure that I've got a certain sense of balance.
Yes.
And so I work well with spreadsheets.
I love it.
And I guess the other thing it taught me, like having three different pretty intense positions over a 15-year period, taught me that I can figure stuff out. And so I guess the writing thing, though, I didn't have as much confidence in the beginning that I could figure it out and kind of be at the party and be at the table.
Right.
And anyway, that was kind of the next important step I needed to take.
Right. Well, I asked that question, one, because I came from a background in corporate law, and I found that transitioning to fiction writing, there was a lot of unlearning. But as you say, it was a lot of, you know, you get the discipline and you get the I can do hard things and the research and all of that stuff was so helpful. But there was a little bit of unlearning from that analytical mind. So I'm loving this answer about I work really well with spreadsheets because, you know, it's great to take some of those things that you could see perhaps being a hindrance to fiction writing and turn it into an advantage that, you know, like your secret weapon, because nobody else probably, you know, not too many other writers have that ability. I mean, spreadsheets give most writers hives. So I think, That's such a great realization. And I really like this insight that you have about spending time in these memoir classes and these prompt classes in drawing out what your unique niche kind of is, and that it's motherhood and that it's, you know, daughtering and mothering and these generational conversations with women. I was talking to somebody else in acting recently, and they were talking about trying to figure out what your niche is. And, you know, you just have to spend the time doing that, I think, to figure out kind of what your, again, what your secret weapon is, what pond you're going to swim in fiction. And so all of that time you spent strikes me as really well spent to now hone in on what these novels are really going to center around. That's really great.
Yeah. I mean, takes me a long time to write these things, so it has to be something I'm really, really care about. I'm really passionate about. I'm just going to segue onto one thing you said about what my niche is. The other thing I really love to do, I am very involved at our temple, and I converted to Judaism 15 years ago, and part of that is a deep dive education. I guess that's obvious, but I've continued to study the Old Testament and the Torah with the rabbi at our temple. And so both of my novels, they don't beat you over the head with it, but I've tried, and Eden was very much an allusion to Genesis, but the Nine is a modern retelling of a story, the Hannah and Samuel story in the book of Samuel. So kind of, I think one thing I'm doing this with my third novel as well that I'm currently drafting, I like to take archetypal plots that go back to the Old Testament and make them modern and make them current and relevant, and because I truly believe they are relevant. And so I do have readers that pick up on it, but I'd say like 90% of my readers don't pick up on it at all.
Really?
But yeah, I mean, it's something that I bring up in book talks and book clubs, and I just think that at least the Genesis thing, people do get that, but I need to sometimes remind them of like the different cues that I think were, which when I wrote them, I thought I was banging people over the head, but pretty subtle. With the Hannah and Samuel story, I think it's just that many people aren't that familiar with the Book of Samuel.
Right.
But it's funny, like different, as I've traveled on book tour to places in the middle of the country where people do take part in more Bible study, there has been a huge appreciation for these allusions. And I'm like, wow, maybe my niche and my market is in places where people are more versed in the Bible and not kind of in this secular, like I live in a very secular part of the country in Massachusetts. And so anyway, it's been really fun to just see the variety of ways people appreciate that thing. But my third novel is going to be a modern retelling of David and Bathsheba, which I'm very excited about. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I want to put a pin in that Bible discussion because I have a couple of questions around that. But why don't we set the stage for the book for those who haven't yet picked it up a little better? It really spoke to me because I'm a brand new empty nester, more of a traditional empty nester because my daughter left for college, not boarding school. But I do identify as a helicopter mom, so that was a little painfully resonant.
We get a bad rap, Marie.
Right? Rap. but I'm going to let you sort of set the stage and take us into the book as you're talking about Hannah and Sam and the Dunning Academy. Kind of lay it out for us a little bit, and then we'll use that as a place to dive off and get into it.
Okay. And just so readers know, this book, The Nine, is set in a boarding school, but it's not necessarily about a boarding school. It's a very vibrant, important setting, but it's really about a relationship, a mother and son relationship, and how it weathers a storm. And that could be any storm. So the title of the book is called The Nine, and The Nine is the name of a secret society that's embedded in the school. And when Hannah gets her beloved Sam to this place, it had been her hopes and dreams to get him to this school. It's beyond anything she had experienced growing up. It's in her way the key to a brighter future. When she gets him there, she's expecting, you know, she's treating it as if she's hit the equivalent of a motherhood home run. And she's kind of enjoying the victory and how well it reflects on her. But this school turns out to be a lot different than either of them had anticipated. The academic rigor, the social pressure, and then Sam becomes a part of this secret society and in so doing uncovers something fairly scandalous that's going on at the school. So he becomes obsessed with figuring out how to solve this wrongdoing, kind of takes it on his own because of certain circumstances. I don't want to give it away, but the point is his mom is at home thinking all is going well and her son is going to make her proud and she's going to have that Princeton sticker, that Princeton decal on the back of her station wagon. So it's really about these two realities, Sam's reality and Anna's reality, having to reconcile. And it's about, you know, this small, fragile family and kind of how they stand up to the forces, this very strong, long-established institution. So, that's kind of how I'll set the stage.
Yeah, so good. And it's coming out at a time when we're kind of steeped in, especially here in Southern California, we're steeped in this admission scandal. The country is steeped in what the country is steeped in, and there are all of these socioeconomic issues, privilege issues, how our country, class issues, how our country is coming to terms with sexual sexual scandal issues. I mean, it's so incredibly relevant. And I always wonder if writers write to their, it was this a case of kind of writing to your own fears? I know it was a case of writing to this mother-child relationship, but I also wonder, if that kind of drew you in of what kind of scares you to your core, and do you write to that?
Yeah, so I started writing this novel in 2013. I was in the midst of revising Eden, which was a whole Rasmus at that point, and I was getting a lot of great feedback, but the feedback was basically, it covers 100 years, and there's four generations of women, and there's all these, there's two timelines that are braided together, and there's all these characters, and it's very interior. And so that was really good feedback, and I put the manuscript in a drawer thinking, I don't really know how I'm going to fix this book. But I did know I had another story brewing inside me, and that was going to be the antithesis of Eden. It was going to be a four-year time period. There was going to be lots of action, and there were only going to be three main characters. So I thought, I'll just write a brand new book that avoids all of the hurdles that I've created with Eden. But at the same time, I was studying the Hannah and Samuel story. At the same time, I was turning my own children over to the world. And the Boston Globe was coming out with stories on a weekly basis about a different boarding school that had been covering up sexual misconduct. I mean, I live in a region where there are dozens and dozens of these boarding schools, which is kind of unique to, I think, the area. But there was didn't seem like there was one that got away with anything. Like there was, it was just crazy. I in doing research for this book, I did a lot of Google searches on scandals, and you could put in different keywords like New England boarding school scandal, and there'd be more articles that popped up than you'd have time to read in like a month.
Wow.
So it was this time, I think, you know, talking about writing to my passion and writing to my fear, it was brewing inside of me because there was such a sense of betrayal as a mother. Now, I need to tell you, I have three kids. They're all in their mid-20s now, but they all went to different boarding schools. And my husband went to a fourth boarding school. I'm from Newport Beach, California, so I'm kind of from where you are.
Yeah.
I went to Newport Harbor High School in the 80s, big public high school. This was not my world. Yeah. And so when my children started having these experiences, I think I paid more attention than your average. Maybe not, but maybe things just made a bigger impression on me because it was so different from where I came from. Anyway, these stories were coming out in the news, and I felt like, you have got to be kidding me. The school that my oldest child went to, in particular, I felt extremely betrayed because while my son was there, he had a little run-in with, he got into a little bit of trouble, your typical teenage misbehavior. He deserved to be punished. Mm-hmm. In the end, his punishment was pretty severe, but he handled it and he took it and dealt with the consequences. But like a year later, I find out that that very same administration that had taken his pound of flesh, you know, had been protecting teachers who had basically had raped children. So I felt so upset by that. I just was like, I didn't know what else to do but write. And so this book stems from that indignation. But I had to obviously revise and work so that it didn't like reek of my own situation. And where early drafts might have been like really about the scandal, I decided I really wanted the book to be about how the family weathers it and survives it. And I've always loved the campus novel, so I was a big fan of Curtis Sittenfeld's Prep and all sorts of different campus novels. A Separate Piece, Lords of Discipline, I could name a bunch. But I thought, you know what? In 2019, the campus novel now has the mother as like a main point of view character.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Crazy as it is, what happens to the kid is happening to everybody in the family. And Anita Shreve wrote Testimony, which has a mother point of view character. She's not one of the main point of view characters, but it was so, like, that's what also made me think, this is how I want to do it. I want this to be about this relationship. So I did write it, everything, it was like a perfect storm of things happening right around 2013.
Yeah.
And so, that's what really got me going on it. And I was writing feverishly on this book, like it had to come out.
Well, and you think about how mothering has changed, you know, in this generation and maybe the half generation before us, of the helicopter mothers overlaid against this boarding school, which when, you know, you traditionally think about a separate piece, it's, you know, you send your kid off and you see them at the holidays and that's kind of it.
So
it is kind of a contemporary telling. And I was wondering if, because you grew up in Newport, and, you know, the boarding school phenomenon is a little bit more foreign to us on the West Coast. It gave you some sort of perspective. I always think it's interesting for writers to write away from a place or from a psychological distance from a place than they're familiar with, because it gives you a really kind of unique perspective on it that those from the inside who were steeped in it, you know, maybe like your husband, may see things slightly different because he was brought up in it. I don't know how you feel about...
No, totally. I mean, I feel like the outsider in a lot of ways. I feel like the outsider in my religion. I feel like the outsider, we go to the summer community for the last 20 years. You know, literally people have been going there for four generations, so I'm always going to be the outsider. And that was the setting for Eden, because I feel like I could kind of write, I had this, like these eye-popping moments, but I also had this commentary, and I feel safe with my commentary because I am kind of entering stage left and like mentioning what everyone else is too afraid to talk about.
Yeah, right.
I don't, you know, I feel allegiance to these places, and I have a certain love and admiration, especially for the town where we spend our summers. But like, these are places that are like dinosaur fossils in the way our country, I mean, in, you know, these places aren't long for this world with the way our country is going, and like the diversity and the extreme, I don't know, just like, there are just very few of these little pockets of privilege and strangeness. So I like to turn them around and investigate, how do these places survive? How did they get this way? Why are the people in charge the way they are? Why are, like, how have they not changed, and how have they not been modernized? And even like with Dunning Academy, the school in the Ninth, in the name of like trying to become more modern, it actually exacerbates the conflict between people on campus.
Right.
So the groups, like, you're trying to bring in people to make the campus more diverse, bring in girls, bring in kids on scholarship, bring in kids from international places. Yet, it's made very clear once you're on campus, like, you better find your own people. And so there's this theme of fraternity, and the Nine is the secret society, but it's definitely not the only fraternity. There's even a group of adults that have their little Friday night group. There's clubs and teams, and, you know, there's different grades, and you're just always being, it's always made clear where you stand and where you don't stand, and I find that very interesting. I was recently on a panel of novelists. We all have recent books that have come out set on campuses. And the thing we really had in common was this obsession with like little groups and cliques and the gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's never, like, you're never ultimately at the top. You can get into the best school. You think you finally made it. But then once you get there, you realize you're just kind of a, you know, you're a nouveau person. You're not one of the old, you know, the old legacy people, or you're not smart enough, you're not this, you're not that, all the different hurdles And I think that that's kind of what life is like, but, I don't know.
Yeah.
For this mom, mm-hmm. she thinks that she's going to get her son to the center ring. The center ring is never going to be accessible to her.
Right, right. It is such a microcosm of the country and how the country is operating and you know, who's losing power. You know, it's a great meditation on power. Can't help mm-hmm. but think of the nine in the Supreme Court somehow.
I know. You know, Jeffrey Toobin from The New Yorker wrote a book called The Nine, which is about the Supreme Court. So unfortunately, we share the same title, and I'm afraid there have been some Amazon searches that might have gone awry. But investigating the title The Nine, it might not be the exact title, but the word nine is used in a lot of titles. So. Same with Eden. I mean, Eden is kind of an iconic word as well. So
Well, bringing it back to the
a lot of people.
Yeah, no, I get that. Well, bringing it back to the Bible theme. The other thing that strikes me about having some little spine or thread, whatever word you want to use, that runs through it, this story of Hannah and Sam in the Bible. And the nod to Genesis in the other is that it gives the writer something to hang on to. We were talking about last week on the show, like a swimming pool. It gives you something to push off from as a writer that gives you some help, you know, as opposed to just mm-hmm. being tossed into the middle of the pool with nothing to push against. And I thought that, you know, if you felt like that was some sort of help to you to have this ribbon of something solid to kind of guide you through the, you know, a 300-page manuscript, which feels kind of overwhelming.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. First of all, I just remember being in English classes where the teacher would point out symbolism or references to the Old Testament, and it just seemed so rich. And like, yeah. I just thought... I tried with each round of revision to add texture and imagery and nuance, but I did start with this foundation of kind of an old story and the most ancient of family stories, actually, and trying to make it modern.
Yeah.
And... I feel like the subtext is, look, human beings have been suffering the same issues for thousands of years, and our family structures have been plagued with the same relationship problems for thousands of years. So to me, it's both comforting and depressing. Because you'd think we'd get better at it. But in a way, if we're always kind of coming up against the same things, I think it makes me feel not as alone. And it makes me feel like that level of comfort that we have been struggling with these things for a very long time. And there's nothing wrong with a mom yearning for a child. So badly that she's barking with God, you know. It's been going on forever. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I find that, yeah, it does give me the structure. And when I, you know, sometimes I depart a little bit from the way the story goes in the Bible and I'm not, like, totally literal.
But I've been studying with my rabbi, and the cool class that she holds once a month is... a midrash class, and midrash is actually a noun, but it's also a verb, which means to kind of fill in the spaces in a story that are missing, in your opinion. So I did start doing a lot of writing around the Hannah and Samuel story at the point in the story where Hannah turns her son over to the priest in the temple and kind of that moment of letting go. But the reason I like to have these allusions in my novels, the thing it allows me to do is have a little bit of a roadmap for how the you know, the archetypal plot goes in the ancient story, and have a little bit of a template for how my story is going to go. So in Eden, where I'm alluding to Genesis, there's this beautiful place that's created. It's a garden. There's some corrupting forces that enter the garden. There's a real kind of change in values in the family. There's a flood that comes through. I mean, these things happen, and they're kind of spread apart. So it's, if you're paying attention, you see these, you can line up Genesis and some of the things that happen with the book. In the nine, I have the Hannah and Samuel story, and I really follow the story very closely, and I take a liberal. So in the Bible story, Hannah turns her son over to the temple and the priest when he's weaned. And in my story, the nine, Hannah turns Sam over at age 14. He's weaned, and he's turned over to the academy and this headmaster. And so from then on, it's really an exploration of that letting go moment. I use these stories, these ancient stories, either as a roadmap or jumping off place, but I guess it makes me feel that I'm grounded in something richer and kind of more primal, like a theme. It's not just my theme, like it's a universal theme, and that's one thing I really like about it. It gives me confidence that it's also a very important theme.
Yeah. And is that there all the way through from your thinking, you know, first draft, or does that come during the spreadsheet phase?
Well, Eden was definitely something I wove that in subsequent drafts.
Okay.
But when I mentioned in 2013, when all these things started happening, I thought, this is just like, this really, this moment when Hannah turns her son over, I can totally relate to it. And how come the Book of Samuel now doesn't mention anything about how this felt for her? I mean, it explains how it was hard for her leading up to turning her over, but the actual turning over, you know, the story then goes and doesn't really mention Hannah's feelings anymore. So I got that idea kind of independent. I didn't start out and say every book I write is going to start with a biblical story. It just kind of, since I've been studying Torah and going to this Midrash class, it just kind of happened both times. So then with my third story, I actually am now doing it intentionally from the beginning. But I had some readers tell me, I really like this thing you do. I really like this thing you do with these making the ancient biblical stories relevant in today's world. And I'm like, you know what? I do think that's a thing I'll continue to do. So the way you said in the beginning, finding your themes and kind of finding your shtick, maybe that's what's, you know, my unique take on things.
And I really love that you allowed your subconscious mind to come up with that, you know, that maybe it wasn't there from the very beginning, and you just kind of figured out how your brain was working with it. And then I just think the subconscious mind is so fascinating, and how it's so much smarter than our conscious brain in coming up with, you know, how
absolutely. Yeah. Like the writing process, a lot of it happens while you're sitting down at obviously a lot of it happens at the keyboard, but then like the really good stuff happens when you're nowhere near the keyboard. If you're constantly thinking things through, like I'm participating in NaNoWriMo right now, so I'm now 18 days straight of working on this manuscript. And when you have like that consistency with your work, then you're thinking about it all the time. And so I get very excited by ideas I come up with when I'm away from the computer too. And that's all the subconscious mind taking over while I'm in the midst of some other mindless act.
Yes, yes. I love that. And I was going to ask if you were in NaNoWriMo, because I know this book, you worked through with this Grub Street's novel generator,
mm-hmm.
Which sounds like it kind of operates in a similar way. But I'd love for you to talk about both NaNoWriMo and the novel generator and kind of, how they've helped these stories be birthed.
Okay. So Grub Street's this great creative writing center that offers classes of varying lengths and all sorts of genre. The novel generator is one of the master classes they offer where you have to apply, and it's a year long, well, it's like a 9-month long class, and the point of the class is to finish with a completed first draft. And then they have other classes that launch you from there with a completed first draft. It's an incubator, and on you can go. But I won't say that I finished that class with a completed first draft, but I did finish the class definitely with an idea of how I was going to frame and structure the story, because I got a lot of great feedback. And then people in that class, like three of us continued, or four of us continued as a writing group. So I really credit my writing group from that Grub Street class with helping me really hammer out this structure, because it is written in the mother's point of view and the first person, and the rest of the book's in the third person. And there were all sorts of versions of whether I was telling it in the present, the past, as a retrospective, and who was getting a voice and who wasn't. So that's what I really struggled with. And then once I had that figured out, like, the story itself wasn't what I was tripping up on. It was really how to structure who the narrators were.
Mm-hmm.
Now, NaNoWriMo is a lot different in that it's 1 month of November, and it's National Novel Writing Month, and it is just go full bore writing. The goal is to get 50,000 words down in the month, so that's about 1,700 words a day.
And you're on book tour.
Yeah.
Dang.
So the but it's wonderful because at its core, NaNoWriMo should be just spewing out a first draft. Right now I'm doing revisions and drafting some stuff, but NaNoWriMo is basically just turn the self-editor, the self-critic, or the critic in your head off, and just jam out 1,700 words every day. And I'm a true believer that you can do anything for 30 days. You can, like, go gluten-free or be vegan or, meditate or, all sorts of practices for 30 days. And then, and it's long enough so you can actually accomplish something, but it's short enough so that you don't think your life is going to be like this forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say with the nine, I think I've participated in the last 3 or 4 years, NaNoWriMo, in just the practice of knowing that there's like thousands and thousands and thousands of other people out there cranking every day in November. And with a group from Grub Street, I've formed we have a Slack conversation going on, and so we're holding each other accountable every day. And it's that kind of, I know there's 18 other people slogging it out, and a lot of them, I might be on book tour, but a lot of them like have really intense full-time jobs, and we're all cranking it out in the wee hours or in the early morning hours or on the fringe or in airports. One day of a few weeks ago, I was driving from Connecticut to Boston from a book event, and I was like, when I get to Boston, there's going to be dirty dishes in the sink, there's going to be a dog, there's going to be mail, and all sorts of stuff that's going to suck me under laundry. And so I just pulled over on the side of the road at a rest stop, and I decided I'm going to write my 1,700 words on the highway, because when I get home, I know it's not going to happen. And so it's like, it's almost the challenge of it, figuring out how you're going to get it done.
Yeah.
And people post funny pictures of where they're getting their words written, but there is something like in the group mentality and the accountability.
Yes.
The book tour is the least grueling because all my events are really in the evening. And so I do have my days. And the beauty of it is I'm often in these anonymous hotel rooms that don't require me to clean or cook or, you know, do chores.
Right.
So I really, I have no excuse.
I love it. I love it. And then at what point do you decide that things are ready to show to the people in the group, the you know, kind of core Grub Street people that you stay in touch with? When do you decide that you're going to release stuff for them to critique?
You know, I probably should wait longer than I do, because I am a believer in getting feedback early and often. I do have one guy, I have one writing buddy now, and I tend to show him very early things to see if I'm on the right track. But if I'm in a class, let's say I usually am in a Grub Street class at some point of every year, and they're 10-week classes, and there's 12 people in the class, and you might get two or three opportunities to workshop. For those, I really try to make these pieces as polished as possible. There's something about not knowing the other 11 people and kind of, you know, you want to show your best side. Although I tell myself, look, make sure you show them stuff nobody's seen before. Like, getting feedback on stuff you've already gotten a ton of feedback on isn't really worthwhile. Let's get feedback on something new. But, I mean, I guess I do have a sense of a standard, especially now since I've published a couple of things. I want to make sure if I'm sharing things with other people, it's something I'm proud of.
Yeah.
But I do have my writing buddy, James, who I'd say, here's a piece of you-know-what coming your way. Tell me what you think. And I also have my husband, who's an amazing reader and gives me good early feedback, and I feel very safe having him see my work. So I guess I have the beauty of two people I feel safe with seeing very early stuff, who I know aren't going to judge me with typos and commas out of order. Then I have, like, my classmates, which is another group where I'm very safe to write things content-wise, but I do have a certain standard. I try to make sure it's at a more polished level. And then I really don't show anything to anybody, like, agent or editor-wise until I'm feeling pretty good about it. I learned with Eden, I showed things a little too early to people who were going to form lifelong judgments about me.
Oh.
And I don't get that. I don't get a second chance, you know?
Yeah. At what point, then, does the spreadsheet come into it? I'm really fascinated by the spreadsheet because it sounds like it's something that could be helpful.
Yeah, so my editor from She Writes Press, who's wonderful, I'll give you the example from Eden. She said, you know, it'd be interesting if you, like, you don't have to have exact balance or symmetry in this manuscript, but why don't you kind of highlight whose chapter, like, each chapter was written from a different character's point of view. Well, not each chapter. There are 40 chapters, and let's say there's 6 people's point of view. And so why don't you, are those chapters all about the same length? Do those point of view characters happen like A, B, C, D, E, A, B, C, D, E? No, they didn't. And, you know, how are, and are some characters getting more of a point of, getting more chapters than others? And so I was like, okay, I have to see this visually. So I created a spreadsheet, each chapter, let's say on one axis, and who got the point of view, how many words it was. And then, you know, I could see, like, okay, Becca, Becca, Becca. Then there's Lily, Becca, Becca. Okay, there's too many Beccas in a row.
Right.
And that was also the beauty of the way that was structured, with two timelines that were woven together. I was able to move some chapters around and change things and actually eliminate some point of views in the process of analyzing it on my spreadsheet. It was a really great tool, because then when I went back to the editor, I said, look, here's the spreadsheet. Everything's color-coded. Every point of view character has their own color. You can see visually that the pattern is fairly regular. It's not like, you know, throwing in some random person as a one-off. And when I showed it to her, well, when I first created it, it really highlighted some kind of problems, because she had the sense that things were imbalanced, and maybe things were imbalanced, but I kind of needed to see it. And then the process of creating the spreadsheet allowed me to correct and make revisions, and kind of, you have this unwieldy, like, 400-page thing. It's sometimes you just have a sense that things are imbalanced, but when you actually look at it on a chart, you can look at it that way. There's been a lot of charts. I've looked at J.K. Rowling had a chart around, like, every chapter and the purpose of it. So I've created spreadsheets in that way as well, like, whose point of view is it? How is this serving the plot? How is somebody transforming in this chapter? Because you do get to a point in a long manuscript where you have to edit some stuff out, and if every chapter is not serving a purpose, you really need to, like, every chapter and every word, every scene needs to be pulling some weight. So I have analyzed my work that way as well, breaking down every chapter. Sometimes chapters are not balanced in terms of length, and then that's a red flag that maybe a chapter should be broken up. I kind of feel like the ideal length for my chapters is 2,000 to 2,500 words. I always want to make sure there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to each scene, and I mean in each chapter, and that there's, like, I could in one sentence say the reason for this chapter is blank. And so I hold myself to the discipline of creating those types of spreadsheets, too.
So great. That's such a great tip. And I also want to bring up She Writes Press. It's a new press to me. You know, I just kind of recently got introduced to it, and I'm loving all of these new presses that are popping up and opportunities for writers. And I can't remember if Eden was published by She Writes or if it's just
no, it was.
Can you talk about them just a little bit, and you know, how you found them and how they've served you well?
Yeah, definitely. I could talk for an hour about it, but I'll be as concise as I can. So I think it's 7 years old. It was started by Brooke Warner, who came from Seal Press. She had a fairly feminist point of view, and thus started a press to serve women authors, female authors, with primarily female audiences, but not necessarily. And she had a belief that everyone had a story that was worth publishing. I'd say 60 or 70% of the works, or maybe less, maybe more 60 or 55% are memoir. Memoir is typically very hard to get published in this marketplace unless you're traditionally published in this marketplace unless you are a celebrity and have a huge platform. So I think that was one of the driving forces to creating this press. She Writes Press publishes two catalogs a year, like 40 in each catalog, so 80 books a year. All of the authors make an investment in their work, and that is what's different about this economic model. So it's called a hybrid publisher. It's somewhere in between self-publishing and traditional publishing. So what She Writes Press brings to the table is an editorial standard. They don't accept everything that comes their way. They have an incredible group of editors. They have a great design team and understand how to do amazing covers and how to package something, and how to, like, what a title should be, and they really help with that whole package, and the cover designers are amazing. They have traditional distribution through Ingram Publisher Services, so you get a sales force, and your book is available wherever books are sold. And they have a great reputation. They were voted the number one indie press, or the indie press of the year in 2019 by the Independent Book Publishers Association. So our books are often reviewed and are eligible for prizes alongside books, and we're not considered self-published, and we're in, like, we're reviewed and in periodicals that traditional presses that have been traditionally reserved for traditional presses. So right. we're making real strides, and it's fun because it's kind of a disruptor in an industry that is based on some very old economic models.
Mm-hmm.
And this newer economic model serves authors who are a little bit more entrepreneurial. So I'd say She Writes Press authors are, for the most part, making an encore career of this. We are all women who are very committed to our writing lives, but we are a little bit more mature and established and can and have the resources of both financially and time to make this entrepreneurial effort. I'm not saying that everybody falls into that camp. There's a very cool thing where there's all sorts of emerging writers and people of color who publish with She Writes Press and who are supported by She Writes Press. But I'd say 75% of us are coming at this with a prior successful career and taking all our business acumen and our commercial instincts and making this new thing happen for us. The other thing that's amazing is that She Writes Press authors are, we call ourselves a sisterhood, and we communicate with each other daily on a secret Facebook page and offer tips, different places, different bookstores that are great venues, different periodicals that are publishing our essays, people who are veterans help out people who are just getting started, and it's really incredible. As I've been on tour, different She Writes Press authors show up in cities where I don't know anybody. And so we're really, really supportive of each other. And so I'm so grateful because I have my community in Boston through Grub Street and all the classes I've taken there. But I really have this, like, nationwide network of women through She Writes Press that's, like, emboldening and empowering. And they're really more of my don't be afraid, be a badass type of, like, commercial instinct women. And then the Grub Street people are who I really trust for, like, the high-minded literary instincts. So I have those two different communities that help me in two different ways.
So great. That's so great. I love this. I can't believe we're out of time. Do you have any last-minute words of advice, wisdom that we didn't cover?
I'd just say to anybody who's out there, don't give up. Don't let anyone tell you your work won't sell. You know, you're creating something that's unique to you, and so just don't give up. There's going to be a reader for, you know, there's a reason you're working on something. I published Eden when I was 52, and I started working on it when I was, like, 40. So, it's, you know, think of this as a long game. Definitely it's the long game, and just don't give up. That's what I would say.
I love it. Jean Blasberg, congratulations. This is great.
Thank you so much, Maria. I love being with you.
Thank you. Thanks so much. And that was Jean Blasberg. That is all the time we have for this week. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. Barbara will be here. Stay tuned for Orion's Belt coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.